Welcome to the Living a Naturally Healthy Life podcast with Delaine ND, the podcast for people looking to correct chronic illnesses such as diabetes through lifestyle change. I'm Dr. Delaine Vaughn. As a physician, I see many patients who are ill because of lifestyle decisions such as food choices. Typically, diseases such as diabetes are managed with pills or injections. This approach creates a vicious, expensive, and unhealthy cycle of medication and then more medication to address the negative side effects. As a physician and a life coach, I work with clients to resolve their diseases, get off their medications, and live a naturally healthy life. If you don't like the healthcare system in America, I recommend you use less of it by being naturally healthy. So if you feel there has to be a better, more natural way to live a healthy life, you are in the right place. Hello and welcome back to the Living a Naturally Healthy Life with Delaine MD podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Delaine Vaughn, and this is podcast number 44. I can't believe that. That seems like a whole lot of podcasts, but that's what number we are on. So if you're new to this podcast, my name is Dr. Delaine Vaughn. I'm a family practice, a board certified family practice physician, as well as a certified life and weight coach. And what I do is I help type 2 diabetics reverse their diabetes so that they can live a naturally healthy life. That's kind of where my passion lies. So if you've listened to a few of these, or as we go through this podcast, you'll notice that I talk about how to live a naturally healthy life just for anybody. That kind of applies to anybody. But the examples that I use are typically examples that apply to type 2 diabetics. And the reason that I do that is because that's who I'm really passionate about helping become naturally healthy. So today we are going to talk about planning. If you've listened to any of my other podcasts, you've heard me talk in the past about the primitive brain and the prefrontal cortex. We're going to take a deep dive into that today. And the reason that we're going to take a deep dive into that is because that is the reason that planning is so important, is that we get to really utilize our prefrontal cortex, which is that part of our brain that is involved in making good decisions. It's what we call the executive functioning part of our brain. That part of our brain weighs pros and cons of each of our decisions and makes the best decision based on that information. Versus our primitive brain, which is the part of our brain that is very, it's called the reptilian brain. It was the earliest developed part of our brain, but it's really run on rewards and punishment, avoiding punishment and seeking out rewards and expending the least amount of energy possible. So we're going to go into that pretty deeply today. And then I'm going to talk about why planning is so important to kind of taking the power away from that primitive brain, that part of our brain that really wants to just seek out pleasure, avoid pain, and expend the least amount of energy possible. Doing those things, seeking out pleasure, avoiding pain, and expending the least amount of energy possible, is almost always not something that serves our greater goals. So let's dive in. So again, a basic review, our brain can be divided into two parts. It can be divided into many, 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 many things, depending on what we're talking about and why we're talking about it. But today, what I'm going to talk about is these two parts, this primitive part of our brain, this reptilian brain, and then the prefrontal cortex of our brain. So let's talk about this primitive part of our brain. It's very carnal, pre-modern. It's motivated by pain and pleasure. It's the part of our brain that looks to avoid pain, seek out pleasure, and again, expend the least amount of energy possible. So tens of thousands of years ago, this part of our brain really served us well. This part of our brain really propagated us as a species. If it was painful, we avoided it. If it was pleasurable, we sought it out, we looked for it, we chased it. And if we could avoid the pain and engage in pleasure and expend very, very little amount of energy, we were winning. Right? So recognize, why do we want to expend energy? Because energy wasn't abundant tens of thousands of years ago. We really had to conserve our energy. Painful and uncomfortable things we avoided, like fire or new experiences or being exiled from our tribe, right? It wasn't even like physically painful things or uncomfortable things. It was also emotionally uncomfortable things or experiences that were uncomfortable. And then, of course, pleasurable or pleasant things, we sought that out. So our bodies developed ways of rewarding us for things that kept us alive, that propagated us as a species. Food is a great example of this. And another great example of this, and I use this as an example because it's so glaringly obvious when you look at it. But of course, my mother, bless her soul, if she listens, I'm talking about sex again, Mom. Here we go. So sex is another really great example of how we as human beings seek out pleasurable things, even sometimes at our own peril, right? At you know, sacrificing something that's actually maybe better for a more evolved part of us. But the reason that we seek food out is because our brain rewards us neurochemically for it, and it keeps us alive. The reason that sex is so appealing to us as human beings is because we do get that neurochemical reward for it. And of course, it propagates us as a species. When we have sex, we make babies. When we make babies, we're successful as a species. The uncomfortable things, being near fire was obviously dangerous, right? So you wanted to avoid that. I mean, that could kill us. So let's not do that. Being around new experiences, that was unknown. It was fraught with uncertainty and had possibly horrible outcomes, right? So we wanted to avoid that. We really had this very narrow, or we were very averse to risk, right? Back then, if we didn't know what was going to happen, we really wanted to avoid it because we were risk averse, because we could die if we made the wrong decision. And then, you know, we talk about being exiled from our tribe. Right. So when we were living in hunter and gatherer times, tens of thousands years ago, pre-modern times, to live on your own, to be exiled from your tribe, to be a loner meant almost certain death. Right. You didn't have anybody to help you out. You didn't have somebody to hunt and gather and somebody to protect and somebody to build and somebody to make clothing to keep you warm. Right. That's something you got to experience in tribal living, not when you were a loner. So unless you were able and well equipped and well trained to do all of those different things, you were kind of in a pickle because you didn't have somebody to help you do those things. So tribal living, again, that was something that we really sought out, being accepted by a group. And we see this even in modern times play out on things like Facebook, right? Why do people like so many likes, quote unquote, on their posts? They want to be accepted. They want to be accepted. Because on a very carnal level, on a very biological level, we are driven to desire that. So we avoided these things that were either dangerous or unknown or known to be unpleasant. We avoided those things. So again, in pre-modern times, in order to propagate us as a species, we put quite a bit of energy into an effort into avoiding these situations. We were risk averse, like I talked about. So this is actually where, you know, you've heard me talk about in previous podcasts about negativity bias, how we as humans are prone to see the negative. You know, you walk into a party, you have a lovely dress on, seven people say you look fabulous, and one person says it looks hideous. You listen, your brain will automatically be drawn and put more emphasis and more importance on that one person who says it looks hideous versus the seven people who said it looks fabulous. I do this with my clients all the time, right? They'll have 28 days in a month where they were spot on plan. They were amazing. They did everything they said they were going to do. They have one day off plan and they're like, I'm horrible. It's all falling apart. I can't do it. That's that negativity bias. Nobody's broken. Nothing's wrong. Our brains aren't sick or, you know, not working right. This is literally how our brains are wired. And why it was is because way back then in the pre-modern times, we had to assess every situation for the negative first, because that kept us alive. We looked for the negative. We avoided it in order to preserve our lives. And this, of course, developed this risk-averse nature that the human being is, right? But of course, the pleasurable things we chased, we would look for the pleasurable things with fervor, right? We'd be chasing them down. Again, sex is one of the easiest things as an example. Intercourse is something that our brains biologically, biochemically drive us to. Our brains release these feel-good neurotransmitters to engage in these activities. Why? Because it makes more babies. It made more of us. It made us more successful as a species. Our brain, of course, releases similar neurotransmitters, these feel-good neurotransmitters, when we eat. Why? Because it kept us alive. So these are the ways that we sought out pleasure frequently in the pre-modern times, right? But these are all great examples of our primitive brain at work. This is the part of our brain that looks to keep us alive and propagate our species. It served us in these pre-modern times.
getting out and eating pre-modern could be dangerous. It, of course, invoked our negativity bias. We could see all the bad things that could happen, and there were a lot of bad things that happened. However, that neurochemistry was so heady and strong that we overrode the negativity bias, the bad things that could happen, and got out there and hunt and gathered anyway, even though when there were obvious dangers associated with that activity. That's how strong and powerful this neurochemistry in our brain is. Once we've moved into these modern times, into our modern lives, where food is overly abundant, this biochemistry in our brain has really backfire. Our current risk of hunting and gathering now has come down to, do I buy Oreos at Dillon's or the Kroger stores for $4.79? Or do I drive over to Walmart and get them for $3.88? The risk associated with hunting and gathering right now is paying too much, right? It's no longer the risk of life and limb. Food has become overly abundant, yet our brain still rewards us biochemically as if it was very scarce, right? Our brain still rewards us with this biochemical, this neurotransmitter for eating foods. And then we do eat these foods, we absolutely eat these foods, but we don't just eat a little of the foods. We eat a lot of these foods, right? Pre-modern, there was just a little of the food available to us. There wasn't an endless supply of berries on a bush, right? You'd eat the berries on the bush and then you were done until the bush made more berries. Now you can go to Walmart or Dillon's and just buy endless pounds of strawberries. There is no limit. So, do we eat the food? Heck yes, we eat the food. We don't just eat a little of it, we eat a lot of it. And not only is it not these naturally occurring foods like berries, like I just talked about, it's these super overprocessed foods like Oreos or Doritos or Ritz crackers or breads or pastas or ice cream or cake or muffins or pies or Skittles or Starbursts. I mean, all of these things, they aren't naturally occurring foods. They're super processed, super carbohydrate concentrated foods. But of course, that's not all. It's not just our foods, right? It's also all of the drinks that we enjoy. It's all the processed foods. It's no longer the carbohydrate and calorie-free water, right? Carbohydrate-free and calorie-free water that we want anymore. Because now we have orange juice or apple juice or Propels or Gatorades or Dr. Peppers or Monsters or Kappa Frappa Chappa Bappas from Starbucks, right? Like, those are all heavily carbohydrate, sugar dense drinks that we drink all day long. So, of course, this has gotten us into trouble. None of these foods are found in nature, but all of them trigger this neurochemistry in our brain. And not just a natural release of that neurochemistry, of those neurotransmitters in our brain, but an over release of these feel good neurotransmitters in our brain. So, this is biology. This is the biology of craving. When you eat these foods and you get this huge release of this feel-good neurotransmitter, this feel-good neurochemistry in your brain suddenly craves these foods. It overemphasizes the food. This leads to desire of those foods. And this is the problem, right? My diabetic clients don't come to me telling me about how they have diabetes because they struggle to stop eating celery, right? It's they have diabetes because they struggle to stay away from things like pasta, or they struggle to stay away from things like pizza, or I can't stop eating peanut butter and jellies, or it's the potato chips or the mac and cheese, right? They tell themselves things like, I just can't do it. I can't let go of these things. It's too hard. I can't imagine my life without these foods. There will be no enjoyment in my life without these foods. We start to believe this. And we start to believe that these foods are the only way to enjoy our lives. And it feels so real to us because the neurochemistry is very real to us. It's the reason that it's so compelling. When I point out that they can manage all sorts of challenging things, my clients, when I point out to them, they can, you do all sorts of challenging things in your life. You budget multi-million dollar businesses. You manage your children's school schedules with their extracurricular schedules. You manage those schedules with your work schedule. You manage those schedules with your elderly parents, doctor's schedules. You have challenging training that you go through to prepare you for your career. You do all sorts of really hard things, but chocolate cake is the thing that you can't seem to manage. And when I point that out, that it's really this neurochemistry point, it's this neurochemistry part of it, and you do all sorts of other really hard things, suddenly there's this huge light switch, this light bulb that comes on. You're like, oh, yeah, that doesn't make a lot of sense. No, it doesn't. So let's talk about the other part of our brain, the part of our brain that saves us from just being at the crazy whims of biochemistry, right? This is the newer, more evolved part of our brain. As I talked about earlier, this is the part of our brain that's able to weigh pros and cons of decisions. And then using those pros or cons, we override that pleasure-pain principle, right? The seeking out pleasure, avoiding pain, and expending the least amount of energy possible. So this is the part of our brain that understands that postponing some pleasure now for a greater reward later has value. Typically, it has more value than the instant gratification. So this has been studied over and over in all sorts of psychological literature. There is a specific marshmallow, probably one of the most famous studies is the marshmallow study done by a guy named Meschler. A psychologist in the 1950s, I believe, is when he did this. But what his study did was he took children of preschool age, and he gave them the option of getting a treat right now. Like, you could have a treat, and it was a marshmallow. Some of the studies he did had pretzels. Some of the studies he did had animal crackers, but it's called the marshmallow study because one of the studies he did had marshmallows. You can have one marshmallow now. Or if you can leave the marshmallow here, I'm going to step out of the room for 15 minutes. I'll be right back. But when I come back, if that marshmallow is still there, I'll give you a second marshmallow. So this was an experiment on delayed gratification versus instant gratification. They had no other distractions in the rooms. If you read the research papers, there were no other distractions in the room. So these children had to just sit and really look at the marshmallow and decide what they wanted to do. So what they found is the children that were able to postpone that gratification, wait for the 15 minutes or however long it was, and get the second marshmallow, those children were far more successful later in life. Like 10 to 20 years out, they had higher incomes. They had lower BMIs. They had higher college entrance exam scores. They were more successful in life than the kids who could not postpone that gratification, who had to indulge in the instant gratification. So it's kind of interesting how this part of our brain works, right? So other places like where you will see this working in your life, I always use the example of when you were learning to budget your money. So when you first got on your own in college and you were learning to budget your money, like there were many times where you wanted to go and spend the rent money at the mall or buy a pair of shoes or go to a party and spend your rent money on a cover charge to get in to see a band you liked or whatever it was, right? Like there's all sorts of things you wanted to spend your money on. And that would have been that instant gratification. That would have been that seeking out pleasure, avoiding pain, expending the least amount of energy possible, right? That would have been you indulging your primitive brain. But of course, your prefrontal cortex kicks in and says, if we spend the money now, we don't have money to pay for rent. And if we don't have money to pay for rent, I might get kicked out and then I have to live on the streets. Living on the streets sounds far less fun than just going without the shoes right now. So I'm going to save the money and not go to the mall and buy shoes, and I'm going to pay my rent on time. Our prefrontal cortex kicks in and does all sorts of things like this. It's well practiced in managing all sorts of really successful things we do in life, all sorts of successful things that we do in business, all sorts of successful things we do driving a car, right? Like every time somebody irritates me on the highway, if I let my primitive brain have its way, like I'm going to ram my car into three or four different cars every day on the road because I think they need to know that they're a rude driver and it's my job to tell them, right? Of course, my prefrontal cortex kicks in and says, no, we don't ram our car into other cars. That's not how we do it because we don't want to pay the bill to have your car in the shop. We don't do it that way. Another example that I always use that most mothers can really relate with, right? Our primitive brain kicks in when we watch somebody do something that we feel, that we deem, that we judge as being unfair to our children. So if you're at the playground with your two-year-old kid and your two-year-old kid's playing peacefully in the sandbox with their toy, and a 3.5-year-old kid comes up, pushes your kid, takes their toy, and then throws sand on them. Like, there is an instant, very, very organic and carnal feeling to go after the kid that just treated your child poorly, right? Like, I'm going to go after, I'm going to teach that kid a lesson. Like, that's the initial feeling. But again, the prefrontal cortex kicks in and says, no, we don't handle things that way. We're not going to go as a 35-year-old person and manhandle a 3.5-year-old kid, right? That's not how it works. We're going to go and do what we need to do, right? We're going to take care of our child, make sure our child's safe, and then we are going to act in a very mature way and go and retrieve our child's toy and handle it that way. We're not going to go take out the 3.5-year-old that we felt treated our child unjustly, right? So our prefrontal cortex overrides our primitive brain frequently throughout the day. We are not well practiced at having our prefrontal cortex override our primitive brain when it comes to food. And this is where planning your food is so important, okay? So there are a number of ways that I work with my clients to teach them to plan their foods. Sometimes it looks like a very specific plan. In fact, I do a very specific plan. I always say you can do this one of two ways. Probably there's more than two ways, but there are two ways that I typically teach my clients. You can have a specific plan or you can live from a protocol. And I'm going to talk a little bit about both of those. So having a specific plan is you just make your plan, right? I make my plan almost a week ahead. Like I roughly plan out what I have, what I want to eat throughout the week. I know that, you know, come midweek, I'm going to want like celery with peanut butter and maybe some raisins on it because I kind of feel like that's a treat. I really like that. I know a couple times throughout the week, I'm going to want some nuts because I enjoy that. I know a few times throughout the week, I'm going to want some eggs and pico de gallo and avocado. Like that's what I like. So I plan kind of knowing what I'm going to like. I plan on Sunday and just know. And then come Tuesday night, it's like time to get in bed. I look at the plan. I'm like, oh yeah, do we have all that food ready? Yes, I do. I pack it up, make sure it's ready. And then I have Wednesday already done, right? But sometimes it's like a friend calls me and they're like, hey, you want to go for lunch? And I'm like, heck yeah, I want to go for lunch. I haven't seen you in years. So if that happens on Tuesday, then I can make that adjustment to my plan for Wednesday accordingly. So it's not always set in stone when I make it on Sunday. But come Tuesday night, my plan for Wednesday is very specific and it is set in stone. So I always do it the night before. I always make my plan and it's typically very specific. And what that allows me to do is to make my plan from that prefrontal cortex where I'm weighing pros and cons. I'm comparing my decision with my greater goals and I make a plan that serves, that honors my greater goals. Okay. The other way to do the planning is to live from what I call a protocol. So you decide what is on plan, what is on protocol for you, and what is not. So sometimes people will say, like, they know what meats they want to eat, like they can't eat. It does well with their body. They don't gain weight on it. They like the way they feel with it. This meat is good. This meat I like the way it tastes. All of those things are the reason that you might put a certain food on protocol. So you go through all the proteins. So that would be your meats, eggs, cheeses, nuts, those kinds of things. So for me, things that are not, would not be on protocol. If I were to live this way, things that would not be on protocol for me are things like red meat, because I tend to break out in a rash when I eat red meat. Shrimp. I don't like it. I can't find a good reason that I should like it. So I don't try to like it. I don't like shrimp. It's never going to be something that I eat. So shrimp's not on plan for me. Not on my protocol. Would not be on my protocol. Outside of that, I can't think of anything. Probably like caviar wouldn't be on protocol for me because I have no interest in trying that. Really exotic meats, probably not going to be on protocol for me because I have no interest in trying those things. But if you do, or like you're interested in trying those things, or you know you like ostrich meat, that's totally fine, right? So that's, you go through that category of food and you decide what's on plan for you. For me, pistachios, almonds, cashews, peanuts, macadamia. I can't think of any nuts that would be off plan for me. Eggs certainly are on plan for me, but some people have like egg allergies, so they're not going to have eggs on plan for them. I used to do a lot of dairy and like cottage cheese, and I would still do cottage cheese because it did not make me feel ill. But I've noticed that like the hard cheeses lately don't make me feel very good, so I don't eat those, but maybe once a week. But they're still on protocol for me. They would still be on protocol for me. I just limit how much I eat them throughout the week. So then you would move on to vegetables, like what vegetables would you like and what vegetables wouldn't you like? Like what are you not going to eat? What would you eat? I have nothing great for examples because I think all vegetables are probably on plan for me. Fruits are similar. Most fruits are going to be something that I would consider. That being said, I'm not going to eat bananas, grapes, and apples every day as being on protocol because I know that that's too much sugar for me. It makes me have a lot of food cravings. I know my body gains weight on it, so that wouldn't be something that I do. But berries a few times a week? Yeah, I do berries a few times a week. That would be on my protocol. You'd look at your fats, things that you would want, things that you wouldn't want. Beef tallow is a fat that some places recommend, especially keto places, people will recommend. I don't do beef tallow because, again, I have this funny allergy to beef. So I am always afraid I'm going to break out with it. So that would be something that would not be on protocol for me. So you go through each category of food and you kind of determine what would be on protocol for you, what would be something you would eat, and then what wouldn't be something you eat. And then you make a decision based on that. At each meal, what you're going to eat. So, if you go out to eat a lot and you're not sure where you're going to go out to eat, living on a protocol is way better than having a plan set firmly beforehand, right? So, if you, for me, like if I go to a restaurant and there's a salad up there and it has shrimp on it, I know that's automatically off the table for me, right? The burgers are off the table for me because I'm not going to eat red meat either. Right. So the other thing you make sure, like, that you have your protocol set out is the things that you won't eat. I'm not going to eat bread every day. Bread is not going to be something that I eat on a regular basis. It's going to be considered on protocol for me. Pasta, all of those things that you're not going to eat, those come off of your protocol also, of course. So when you're at the restaurant, you know you're not going to have the linguine because it's got pasta in it and that's not on protocol for you. So that's the other part of planning. Again, this protocol that you come up with is made from that prefrontal cortex, that part of your brain that weighs the pros and the cons of your goals, like the pros and the cons of your decisions against your goals, and it honors the goal. You make a decision that's honoring that goal. And you do it ahead of time because, in the moment, if you allow yourself to make your decision, that primitive brain will typically override your prefrontal cortex better judgment. And that's really where the planning component of it is so important, right? You want to start making a plan and you want to follow through on the plan, never allowing that primitive brain to get in there and make any decisions. I always like to look at the primitive brain as like a child. People have heard me say this before, so I'm sorry if it bores you, but I think it's so spot on. If you think of it like a child with one of those really thick black permanent markers, those packing markers that you can get, that you can sniff them and get high, those markers, those really, they're packing markers. They're meant for marking packing boxes, right? They smell really strong and they're super, super permanent, right? I know they're super permanent because my children used them on carpet once and I had to get that out of carpet. They're super permanent, trust me on this. But this is the story, right? Like, a child with a marker like that left unattended in your home, again, take my personal experience here, they'll ruin your home. They will trash it out. And they don't do it because they're malicious and bad kids. They're just being kids, doing what kids do, right? But it wreaks havoc on your home. It's the same thing with your primitive brain. Your primitive brain isn't bad, it's not malicious, it doesn't want to sabotage you per se. But it's just doing what a primitive brain does. A primitive brain seeks out pleasure, avoids pain, and expends the least amount of energy possible. It's just what it does. What a child with a marker needs is a watchful mother keeping an eye over them so that we can be sure that they're using the marker on things that are meant to be marked on, like paper or cardboard, not my walls or my carpet, right? That's what a watchful mother does. That prefrontal cortex is like the watchful mother. Yes, I see you, primitive brain. I see that you're angry that I'm not going to let you have Oreos today, and that's okay. It's going to pass. The same way, when my child wants to go write on the wall with a marker and I tell them, no, we're not going to do that, they may pitch a fit initially, and that's okay. It's going to pass. And that's the kind of training that you need to do with your brain, right? You need to train your brain that we're not listening to that part of we're not listening to the part of my brain that doesn't serve and doesn't honor my bigger goals. That's not the part we're listening to anymore. We're living from a part of our brain that does serve and honor our greater goals. And getting in the habit of planning your food and executing the plan as you have made it, that's the part that really trains that prefrontal cortex and really kind of trains that primitive brain that they're not in charge anymore. This, of course, is what I work on with my clients. If that's something that you feel like really resonates with you, this is the work I do with my clients. This is the work that coaching really helps with. So if that's something you're interested in, if you're interested in working with me, send me an email at delaneatdelanemd.com and we will set up some time to talk and see if my program's something that you're interested in. But if not, and you're trying some of this planning stuff and you're struggling with it, by all means, don't hesitate to send me a message. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have that you might be struggling with as far as this planning component goes, because it really truly is the part that really, one, gets you to that naturally healthy life, and two, kind of breaks you free from those compelling forces of food. So try it out, let me know how it goes, and I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe and share with your friends and family. Also, leave me a review. If you want to resolve your diabetes naturally without any pills or injections, I can help you. Visit DelaneMD.com for more information. Click on the Work With Me tab, send me a message, and we can set up a mini coaching session. You guys have a great week. I'll talk to you soon.